There. This is Rich Sparago, known on Twitter as DT Mets Fan and Mets Fan Rich, and you are listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike on a kind of a sad edition. You know, we'll get into that, but we really thank you for listening, whether you're listening live now or as a download. Thanks for spending some time with us, and you know, why don't we get started here? So let me bring on one of my colleagues in podcasting. That would be Mr. Mike LeColin, who hails from the wonderful borough of Brooklyn. So, Mike, how are you doing tonight?
Doing well, chugging along. Thank you. How are you, Rich?
Doing well. You know, there's always a lot to talk about with the Mets, isn't there, Mike? I mean, you and I go back a long way, and one thing this team is not short on is news. I wish more often the news were good, and it's not in this particular case. So I think we have to start with the 800-pound gorilla in the room, Mike, and talk about where our New York Mets find themselves at this point, and exactly where that is eliminated. They've got the big E next to them when it comes to playoff contention, both in terms of divisional competition as well as the wild card. So the Mets were officially eliminated yesterday, September 25th, after spending over 100 days in first place from early May through early August. So, Mike, I'm going to start there because – and here's why I want to start there before we start diagnosing. How does that feel to you? And let me tell you why I'm asking that question. You and I are longtime Mets fans. We both go back to the early 70s. The Mets have been eliminated a lot in our lifetime. Now, for me personally, this year really, really stings. I don't necessarily know why that is. I'm guessing it's because they were in first place for a while and I expected more, and they've just bottomed out. So, Mike, let me ask you that question. How does their being eliminated this year, with the backdrop of all the frustrations we've had for the last 50 years, land on you at this point?
Rich, we had expectations. That's why this one stands out more than others. As you say, you know, we go back to the 70s, and we've been through a lot of unfruitful seasons. A lot of them, you know, are hard to distinguish one from the other. But every so often there's one that really sticks out. This is definitely one of them. Here we are a few days into autumn, and, you know, it got dark real fast for the Mets. You know, we knew the division was underperforming. You know, we tried to think that the Mets were, you know, in the midst of sustaining that competitive level, you know, but man, it really fell apart fast. And but again, we entered the season with expectations. You can't be disappointed with what you don't expect. Unfortunately, you know, there's a collection of players on this team that, you know, we thought they were going to do otherwise than what happened and transpired over the season. You know, they've already clinched the losing record. They can't even achieve par, you know. So that, and as you say, getting eliminated from playoff contention, the Brewers clinching the Central at our expense today, you know, rather fitting, I guess. But we have problems that need to be addressed.
Yes, definitely. So let's start with, all right, yeah, there's a lot to unpack with what you said, and I like a lot of what you said. So expectation-wise, you know, going into the season, I know we talked about this in our first podcast of the year, right before the season started, and I think we were all around the, you know, 86 win-ish, 87. I think we were kind of riding the Francisco Lindor high. and the Mets aren't going to get there. They're lucky to get to 76 or 77 wins at this point. And so I think that's part of it. I think the other part, like you said, is because the division was eminently winnable this year. And that's probably what it is for me. I mean, they underachieved my and our expectations, sure. But this was the year where everybody else really put it on a silver platter. Like everybody was saying, look, we don't necessarily want it. You guys take it. Now you guys take it. And the Mets didn't take advantage. And especially after being in first place, you know, for over 100 days. So maybe that's what it is. You know, maybe that's it's a combination of expectation and the fall from grace. So, Mike, if I had to ask you, let's get into diagnostics a little bit here. Opinion would be the primary driver. Like, why did this team fall apart? What are you seeing?
Oh, boy. There's an awful lot of things. You know, one point is, after all that we've already said, we also have to curb our enthusiasm. This club set a record for most players on the 40-man roster, if I'm not mistaken, well and above 50 players. So injuries took a major, major toll. We lost our ace for, you know, the better part of the season. So that was problematic. And we also lost Lindor for, you know, a chunk of the season. But, you know, the number one factor has to be the offense. Not everyone was injured. We had still a core that we were able to put on the field every day throughout those injuries. The pitching was there for us in the first half of the season, not so much in the second half of the season. But still, sometimes, Rich, especially in today's age, you have to out-hit your mistakes. And the Mets didn't do that. Far from it. You know, a lot of people underachieved this season. It's unfortunate. And, you know, they're up for review, so to say. So, you know, a lot of underachieving bats. I would put that at the top of my list, Rich. You know, injuries being second, and then luck, you know, bad luck being third. A lot went into the season. You know, we can go the organizational route, you know, because that predicates everything, you know, or we could keep it between the lines. And both of them actually are underperforming.
So let's talk about that, you know, and let's face it, it's what we do. It's what we do as sports fans in any sport. We do call people out. So you said, Mike, and I agree with you, that the underperformance of the offense is probably cause number one, and I think that's right. Clearly, in the beginning of the season, the Mets were able to remain competitive because of strong pitching. Okay. Well, that strong pitching took a hit in the middle of the season when DeGrom went down, and then you saw some other things. So you saw most namely Taijuan Walker appear to hit a wall, and his ERA is over 7, you know, I think since the All-Star break, which is unfathomable. So he appeared to hit a wall. Different things happen in pitching, but the offense, like you said, is probably the number one reason. So now let's peel that onion back a little bit. Just from your perspective, not necessarily looking at numbers, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. Who were the biggest underachievers based on where you think that player should have been or where you expected that player to be versus where that player ended up? You can give me a couple offensively.
Offensively? Well, I think you have to start with Michael Conforto. You know, he's been back on the field for some time now, and he just hasn't performed. Rich, in September, he's played 22 games, and he's done everything but carry the Mets. 2 home runs, 14 runs batted in September. That's not how you carry your team down the stretch. And obviously there's more bats at play here. You know, Pete Alonso did his part. 35 home runs, you know, upwards of 90 RBIs he'll finish with. But insofar as, you know, the underachievers, Michael Conforto tops the list. And Dominic Smith is a close second. I feel more badly for Dominic Smith because he's somewhat of a nomad right now on the team. He has no position. We stick him out on left. Sometimes we put him at first. And it's unfortunate, and it's hard for players to get into a rhythm when you're playing under that condition. So I'm willing to be a little bit, you know, softer with Dom, but Michael Conforto, not so much. This was obviously his walk year, his contract year, and it looks like he's facing a qualifying offer because, you know, his performance doesn't warrant much else. You know, Scott Boras or no Scott Boras. So, you know, and of course, Lindor, he's picking up. He's had his moments, but I still give him the benefit of the doubt. But he's certainly not what his baseball, well, he hasn't performed to the point where the baseball card suggested when he was still with Cleveland. You know, and of course, Baez, that was the late acquisition. So, you know, we can't really add him to the equation and come up with the sum of why this team and who on this team underachieved. Brandon Nimmo was fine. He just can't stay on the field. And you know what they say, Rich, a player's best ability is his availability. And, you know, Brandon Nimmo has a hard time staying on the field, not just this year, but in previous seasons. But, yeah, unfortunately, and Rich, you and I are both big fans of Michael Conforto. I want to see him stay. But, you know, his performance this year, especially down the stretch, he played all of August, he played all of September so far to date, and it's just not there. It's just not there. Two home runs in September, like I said.
Hard to argue, Mike. I'm a huge Michael Conforto fan. It's been a rough year for him. You know, I'll even throw in Jeff McNeil, who's been a little bit better lately, you know, as a very lately.
Agreed.
But, you know, another underperformer, right? Yeah.
And you know, and, again, he's another player who's simply problematic on this roster because he has no real position. And that's something I want the Mets to address and fix and correct.
Yeah. No, we're going to get into all that because I do have some – we can get in as we start to – go into the part of our show where we look a bit forward, you know, we'll pose a couple of interesting questions to solve for that. So, yeah, the offense clearly is what went wrong with this team, you know, and you and I were talking about this just before we went on the air about when we thought, it's a question I threw out on Twitter and got a lot of responses, a lot of very interesting ones, about when I asked our fellow Mets fans, when did you think it was over for the Mets? Like, you know, and fortunately, nobody flippantly said opening day. Everybody actually gave a reasonable answer with a reasonable explanation as to why they thought that. So I'm going to ask you to opine, Mike, but I'll say what I had in mind when I threw the question out. I said, you know, for me, it was the Marlins series. I held on to hope because I didn't think the division was very good. And even the wild card, remember, this is before the Cardinals, who now have won 16 in a row, which blows my mind. But anyway, before they went crazy. But, you know, the Mets were, you know, four or five out in the division at that point going into the Marlins series, and there was a month of baseball to play. Come on, they had a shot. Yes, I know the schedule was tough, but you had a shot. And even you had a double shot. You had a shot in the wild card. They were three and a half out of the wild card, I believe, at that point. But when they weren't able to take care of business against the Marlins in Miami, you know, and they lost 2 out of 3, that's where I started to say to myself, if you can't go in there when you need those games and win at least 2 out of 3, let alone sweep, that kind of tells you you're not really good. So, Mike, for you personally, what was the sign that you said, you know what, you said to yourself one day, it's not going to happen this year? When was that?
Well, the sign and the event to me are two different things. The sign to me was Taijuan Walker's downward trend. Through the end of June, he had a 2.57 ERA. He presently has a 4.57 ERA, which is to say, starting on July 1st, it's been, you know, clicking upwards ever since. The event, Rich, I have to go back to the home and home series with Pittsburgh. That's to me where this downturn started. That was July 9th through the 18th. We won 3 of 7 from the Pirates. And ever since then, we are 32-54. That's over 20 games below 500. So to me, you know, Pittsburgh, you're talking about Central Division bottom feeders. I don't want to be, you know, derisive about it, but you have to beat these teams. You just have to. And they falter. And they've been faltering ever since. There's only streaks involved with losing streaks. There was no consistency after that. Everything was just, you know, throwing darts in the dark and seeing where they land. And I have to point to that Pittsburgh series, you know, splitting four games here at Citi Field and then losing two out of three over at Pittsburgh. I needed more. I needed more. I needed them to be successful during that little run before we met Atlanta and before we met Philadelphia, you know, and before that 11 games part in the schedule where we faced the top Western Division teams. You know, that was supposed to be nourishing for us. We were supposed to get healthy against the Pirates, and it just didn't happen. And the summer has been an utter failure ever since.
You're not wrong by any stretch of the imagination. You know, you saw it much, much earlier than I did because, and I'll tell you why maybe, and I'll throw these out and ask for your comment. To me, losing four out of seven to the Pirates, you know, right before and right after the All-Star break, it's like, it was an eye roll, Mike. It was like, oh, typical Mets. You know, they're not going to do what we think they should do. But I was like, they'll be fine. But, oh, God, eye roll. But, no, it was more serious than that. And it turns out you're right. But here's why I didn't lose hope. And I'll throw a couple of things out. I think about the series right after the Pirates. Well, first of all, they won the last game of that Pirates series after going behind 5-0 in the first inning on a Michael Conforto who had been in the abyss and kind of still is. He hit, you know, the home run off of Rodriguez, their closer, who's now the Braves, in the ninth inning. Here's a guy who, you know, oh, Conforto has to get hot and carry us. Bam! Home run in the ninth inning to put the Mets ahead after being down 5-0. We feel great, at least I did, because not only did they have a great comeback, but it was Conforto who did it. Then they go to Cincinnati. They win that amazing game the next night where they ended up winning 15-11, where, you know, they had they were behind. They came back. The Reds tied it. It looked like the Reds were going to win it. They had a gold opportunity. The Reds didn't score. Mets exploded. And if you remember, the Reds actually had a tying run at bat in the bottom of, I think it was the 11th or 12th, when Anthony Banda was the winning pitcher, right? So you had that game.
Yeah.
Then you have the Marcus Stroman shutout, right, 2 days later. 7-0 they won, I think, through a two-hitter. Okay, looking good. Remember the Braves series end of July when Conforto threw the guy out at the plate, I forget who he threw out, but got the plate to preserve the win? And you're like, oh, this team's got some magic. But even though, right, I've just thrown out three isolated events, and to your point, they weren't streaks. They were isolated events that never became streaks. And me, being the optimistic fan that I never really thought I was, but maybe I am, I thought they were going to become streaks. So, but you're 100% right, Mike. They couldn't sustain anything, and that was the issue.
And Rich, I'll take it a step further. Yeah, you know, that was perhaps Michael Conforto's highlight of the season. But what are we talking about? We're talking about July. What happened to August and September? As you say, there was no streak. There was no consistency. Meanwhile, Bryce Harper was picking it up for Philadelphia. And he sustained, and he's still sustaining. And he's carrying them. You know, where it gets them, that remains to be seen. But the Atlanta Braves also rebuilt themselves after some, you know, tough injuries. They rebuilt themselves at the trade deadline. And right around then is when, you know, I kind of sensed that, okay, Philly and Atlanta are on the way. You know, our easy period is over. This is when we have to contend. And like I said, I'll point back to that record again, Rich, 32-54, 23 games below 500 since the Pittsburgh series.
Awful. And when numbers like that, they, I mean, right now, you just threw cold water in my face. It slaps you in the face when you see, hear those numbers, because those numbers are abysmal. They're abysmal for any team, let alone a team that was in first place. And with that said, let me welcome on our grand poobah of podcasting operations who has joined us, Sam Maxwell. Sam, how are you tonight?
I am good. Just doing some driving around Jersey City. And, yeah, you know, just hearing, like you said, a cold splash of water on the face, Rich. It's crazy how awful this team was during this stretch that took them out of contention.
So, Sam, let me just catch you right up. So the question that Mike and I were talking about just now, I'd like you to answer it as well, is, and I know you did on Twitter, and you can tell the folks what your answer was. When did you have the feeling that, oh, God, this isn't happening for the Mets, this team is not going to the postseason? I know you responded to the question, so why don't you share with people when you thought that the Mets were not a postseason team?
Well, it's interesting because I'm having trouble selecting in my memory where what I said. But, like, in the moment, off the top of my head, I do feel as if it had the exact opposite feeling as the series against the Nationals in 2015, and that was the series against the Phillies after the trade deadline. And basically similar dates. I still held out hope, but, like, looking back on it now that they've been eliminated, I have to pinpoint it as that, just because it just really, to its core, on a visceral sense, felt like the complete opposite feeling that we had back in 2015 against the Nationals.
That's a good point. You know, for those who don't remember that series, that was August 6, 7, 8. On the August 6th game, the Mets, it was a nip and tuck, and I believe the Phillies walked them off in the bottom of the ninth. It could have been the bottom of the eighth, but I believe it was a walk-off.
Well, I'm sorry to catch you. If I'm remembering correctly, was it was it then, or was it basically like the first, second, and third of August? And I'm driving right now, so I apologize. I don't have it in front of me, but
no, that's fine. It was the 6th, 7th, and 8th that they were in Philadelphia. It was a weekend series, and the 6th, I believe they were walked off. The 7th was the game where they were behind and they staged a furious comeback in the 9th, and they fell a little bit short. And then the 8th was the game where Wheeler anesthetized them and beat them 3-0. And I think they had 2 hits the entire game. That was the game where Baez.
I got the dates wrong, but that's basically it. Yeah, exactly.
That was when they fell out of first place. They fell out of first place on the 6th of August. They actually went to a tie, and then they fell out the next day. And then on the 8th, after Wheeler put them to sleep, that was the game where Pete said, you know, we've got this, you know, don't just think no, and we've got it, and smile and all that stuff. At that point, I believe they were a game and a half out after that Sunday game. And really, you know, after that, they played the Nationals 3 games at Citi and swept. So then that's when, you know, dumb me, I was like, all right, well, you know, they took care of business against the Nationals. They had to. They swept the series. Good. Very good. But then from there, it all went in the pooper, because that's when they played the Dodgers and Giants 13 games in a row. And when you go 2-11, a lot of people answered the Twitter question with that, because when you go 2-11 against any opponents, I don't care if it's 27 Yankees, that's bad. You know, 2-11 is just not acceptable, especially if you're a team that intends to win something or purports to be a winning team. You cannot go 2-11 against an opponent, against two opponents. And they were swept by both of those opponents at Citi. They won the two games on the road. So that, a lot of people said, was it for them. And I think that's very fair. What it really showed was they can't compete with the big boys, because they had gotten their butts kicked by Philadelphia. Then they beat a bad team in the Nationals. They swept them, but then they got their butts annihilated by two good teams. And how much more do you need to see that this team is kind of a bottom feeder itself? They beat another bottom feeder, but they can't, they don't just lose. They get wiped out by good teams. It's a lot of the answers were what you guys have said. And And now, all right, we'll get to the going forward in a moment. There are a few more things I want to talk about before we get there. So another thing I wanted to ask you guys, well, let's frame it up this way. The last time we had a podcast was September 16th, and it was a wonderful one. We had Nick Davis, Once Upon a Time in Queens. But the reason I bring that up now, that was 10 days ago, guys. The Mets have won one game since then. Let that sink in. They've won one baseball game. Now, they had a couple off days, absolutely. But baseball is basically an everyday thing, and the New York Mets have won one baseball game in the last 10 days. That's crazy bad, right? So just for context, they lost 2-3 to the Phillies. Then they go to Boston. They lose a two-game series. And then just now, they got whitewashed in Milwaukee by the Brewers. So here's my question coming out of all that. Okay. Let's say for argument's sake that by the time they started playing the Phillies, when we had finished our podcast, they were on life support. They had just gotten swept by the Cardinals. Playoff-wise, they're on life support, but they had a weird chance. You know, they could have won and then gotten some help. Here's my question to you. They've been basically out of it, let's say, since that Phillies series. Do you think this team has looked like it's mailing it in? And that's a harsh thing to say about any professional sports team mailing it in. That really hurts to say. But let me ask you this. They've lost, which is one thing. My opinion, they've looked horrendous doing it. They've looked lifeless. They've played bad baseball. And I know VR is a bit of a wild guy, but him getting thrown out when they were down 8 runs, making the third out at third base. You see stuff like that. Remember that game, that pop-up that dropped as well? There's a couple of pop-ups dropped in that game. Do you think – you guys know the question I'm asking. I'll go to you, Sam. Based on what you've seen since they've been, for all intents and purposes, eliminated, is this team mailing it in?
Sam? You said my name, so I'm going to pick it up. It's hard to say that they're mailing it in only because of those one run, the statistics regarding how many one run losses, which is, you know, I'm constantly making the point that this is literally been the story of the Mets since 1962. I believe, and this is coming from Greg Prince, also coming from a book he quoted. But that in 1962, the Mets had the tying run on deck or on base 56 of the 120 losses. And, you know, most likely not all of them fall like that, but they're probably not a 100-loss team if half of those fall. Shoulda, woulda, coulda, if ifs and ands with pots and pans, there'd be no need of tinkers, as my dad always said. But because of that stat, it's hard for me to say that they're mailing it in. But I want to focus in on, and I believe it's like a combination of Conforto, Davis, and McNeil, and I think Throw and Dom collectively have 35 home runs, excuse me, between the three or four of them. And so any talk about, I understand that Lindor has kind of, you know, set the tone for the offense, but has also been hitting since June. Javi Baez, especially since Bugate, has been knocking the cover off the ball. And if you looked at some quotes of his, he seems to have understood what he did wrong and grow not only as a batter, but as a human being, potentially. So all of this hatred towards Lindor and Baez, this idea that we shouldn't sign Baez because he hates the fans, I just want to just, like, go on the record audibly as get the F over yourselves. Enough is enough. Can we stop with this? Because basically you are being as sensitive as you are saying the players are being about you. So please, enough is enough and pay attention. I know that it's kind of going off a little bit from your original question, Rich, but that's basically my entire answer. I think that if anybody's phoning it in, it's some of those players, and they need to get, you know, take some of the flack for it more than some of these other players are. And, you know, Conforto's coming up on a contract. So how can you say that he's phoning it in? It's very nuanced question and answer, and I guess in a nutshell, no. I think they just suck.
Fair.
So that's what I. Mike, same question to you. Do you think it's just, hey, you know what? They're not very good, and they're getting their butts kicked, or is there some element of phoning it in? What do you think, Mike?
I'm going to take an opposition point of view. As Sam just said so eloquently, the Mets suck. I'm going to look at the opposition. St. Louis was in the midst of a 15-game winning streak when they swept the Mets. Philadelphia, it was just time. You know, early in the season, we had a winning record against Philadelphia. Now we have a 9-10 record against Philadelphia. So, you know, that found its true level. And then Boston and Milwaukee, they simply had more to play for. Obviously, Boston is in the wild card chase to win the division because of St. Louis's winning streak. So, you know, those four teams right there, they had an awful lot more to play for than the Mets. So, you know, perhaps frame of mind comes into play, whereas the Mets might have been feeling down on themselves and, you know, the other teams were up and ready for the challenge. But I do think players come to the park every day looking to win. It may look like they're phoning it in. It may appear that way. And sometimes they even behave that way. But, you know, they're human. They're humans just like us.
All right, guys. Thanks for sharing that. I do think, and maybe it's, you know, you might be right, that they're coming to the park prepared, you know, trying to win. And I don't disagree with any of that. But to me, it's like I haven't seen a lot of top step. I haven't seen a lot of, you know, it just seems like there's something missing. They seem flat to me. I think you could say, look, you know, I came to the ballpark. I hit in the cage. I took my grounders, took my fly balls. I'm mentally ready to go, and that's fine, and that's the cost of entry. But as far as I'm concerned, something is short. There's something missing. There's not the fight. There's not the you know what? Let's win this damn game. It's like, you know, I'm going to be prepared. I'm going to do my thing. But it's like, where's that collective desire to win? I don't see it. And again, I'm not saying it's not there. I'm saying I don't see it. But again,
Rich.
Go ahead.
I agree with it.
I wanted to go with that. Really, like, this is three straight seasons with the same, you know, other than like the players that I was talking about that were here in the Steve Cohen era only, Lindor and Baez. This is three straight seasons we've been hearing that it's this great clubhouse with this certain collection of guys. And this is three straight seasons that the Mets are going to be outside looking in. And so when I'm looking at this offseason, I really think, and I said it in terms of like, if you think about it like a starting five and then a sixth man, my starting five, the only people that I really deem untouchable are DeGrom, Lindor, Baez, Alonso, and I'll throw Dom in there, and why don't we also say Luke? I think from there, you know, like some players maybe I'm not mentioning because you can assume like Lugo's going to be back, but that's basically the only people that I want to concern myself with in this offseason is working around basically four or five players only. Everybody else, it's up in the air what to do.
Okay. And we're going to get to that. I want to get to the going forward part. And by the way, thank you all for listening. And you're listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. And we have hit a little over 30 minutes. And so, guys, with this discussion, I want to do one more thing on the current team. And then what I want to do is start taking a look going forward. I know we're going to do a lot of that after the season, which ends a week from today. But okay, here's where I want to go. So one of the pieces I put on Mesmerize this week came from watching the Once Upon a Time in Queens. So here's what I put out there. I'm going to ask you two separate questions, one at a time, and ask for your reaction. So, yes, The 1986 Mets had more talent in this team, of course, not questionable. Okay. What I saw having watched that, and I've now watched it twice, I thought about what else is missing from this team. What is coming up short? First thing that I, after thinking about it and watching a couple times and writing about it, here's what I came up with. The first thing is the chemistry on the team. And here's what I mean by that. Sam, and it's a great – I'm going to go to you first. It's a great segue from what you said. We talk – we hear about great chemistry and all that. But here's what I see, and I want you guys to react to it. Pete Alonso, when he makes an out in a tough spot, he'll break a bat over his knee. He will absolutely do that. Jeff McNeil, when he makes an out in any spot, will curse up a storm. We hear it on the parabolic mics all the time. Okay, fine. They're, to me, these guys get angry when they individually fail. And that's okay. That's to be expected. You get paid for this. You want to have a big contract. I totally get that. Totally respect that. What I don't see from this team that I saw in the documentary, and I lived through it, of course, in 86, it was the collective anger. We were going to stomp the living crap out of the Atlanta Braves. We were going to stomp the living crap out of teams that came to Shea Stadium. We were going to – and you heard what they said. I won't use the words they said, but they said we were going to go into your town and do all these horrible things. I don't hear a lot of wheeze on this. I don't. I see guys breaking bats when they fail. I don't see post-game shows where they're like, we have to go in there and we have to beat this team. We. I see a lot of individualized accountability, but not a chemistry that is about the one goal that 86 team had. That team was united around one thing. We were going to win a World Series. I don't see that with this team. I don't see them talk about the we's and how we're going to go out and we need to beat the Cardinals. You know, if they're coming in here, we need to capitalize on what we just did against the Yankees. We need to sweep them because we got to get to the postseason. I don't see enough of that. Guys, that's my question. Maybe there's chemistry, but is it the right chemistry in the right place? Sam, go with it.
Doran, I keep bringing up Baez, and McNeil and Lindor got into something. So if this is where, like, the wrench in the gears of whatever clubhouse chemistry it is, you know, I do believe that McNeil is a very useful player going forward. But, like, this is where, like, Lindor, we have more invested right now in Lindor over the next 10 years, and why I keep saying this is who you need to build this team around. And if there's something missing because of whatever nuances, the way the clubhouse doesn't come together, and maybe Lindor didn't completely fit with whatever was going on before, I don't care anymore because this is who it needs to be worked around because basically, you know, Alonso's the vocal guy. He's supposed to be the face of the franchise leader, but I'm telling you, it's Lindor, and right now, Mets fans need to stop talking about the idea of trading this guy because that's not going to happen. Work your team around DeGrom. Work your team around Lindor. And if clubhouse chemistry is that's part of the factor, then it needs to you need to consider some of these, you know, big boy questions and these big boy decisions that are going to have to be made. So, you know, I completely agree with you, Rich. And again, if it has something to do with, you know, like the nuances of players like that, with the rat and raccoon type of thing, well, then that's my decision. You gotta side on the Lindor side.
Mike. Mike, I think you're muted.
Yes, I was. That's difficult. We know the 86 Mets had a large set of onions. Even the 99 and 2000 Mets, they had mojo. The 2015 Mets, they were identifiable through young pitching and young players coming up. This team is very undistinguishable from the next pedestrian team down the street, you know. They lack something. They lack a lot. I agree with you, Rich. They don't have that chutzpah about them. There's a lot of me and less we. I agree with that. some of that might be generational. I don't know. So I'm not going to go out on that limb. But it's weird. It's weird. I think everyone's up for review. No, Lindor's not going anywhere, Sam. Not with that contract. But everyone should be up for review. And it starts with the front office. I don't want to be, of course, but, you know, they're the ones who have to decide who's on the roster and who's not and what kind of collection of players best fits this town and what kind of talent it's going to take to win.
So with that, thanks, Mike, for that, Mike. And with that, I said, okay, so this chemistry to me creates culture, right? I had an enormous problem. I don't think we're talking about this enough as fans. I had an enormous problem when Lindor and Baez were made to come out and apologize for the Bugate thing. They were not the only ones involved, okay? That bothered the hell out of me, that you singled two guys out to wear it for the team. And I thought that was really poorly done because, to me, it's like, You made these two guys go in front of the cameras as sacrificial lambs and essentially apologize to the fans. This is a team-wide thing. That was nonsense. I'm sorry, that's nonsense. That bothered the living hell out of me. And to me, that's a culture issue. And I don't mean culture, race, and that stuff. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this should be we're a team. And if there was a team leader or something like that, someone who could have said collectively, you know what, guys, it was all of us. It was all of us. We talked about it in the clubhouse. We thought it was funny. It wasn't funny. Fans, we're all good, right? Okay, fine. This was two guys who had to go in front of the cameras and say, it was all us. No, no, no. It was just two of us. We're the ones apologizing. Nonsense. I'm calling that nonsense. What do you guys think of that?
I'm with you on that, Rich. It was nonsense. It was folly in a season filled with folly. You know, there was a lot more to it than just that. You know, you had Squirrel, Ratgate, and a myriad of things that just went wrong. But I agree with you on that. They got called to task on that, just those two. And as you say, there were more people involved. So more people should have stepped up for them and spoke perhaps on their behalf. That's what teams do, teams.
And
teams,
wasn't McNeil involved
teams.
Too?
They were all involved.
Right, so it's,
you know,
like
Rich,
it kind of like goes
sorry.
Against – no, sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
No, go right ahead, Sam, please.
No, I was just going to say that, like, you know, it goes how – you know, against the idea that McNeil has not molded well with Lindor or vice versa, really. But I completely agree with you, Rich, that, you know, I've been mentioning it probably ad nauseum for a lot of people with Lindor and Baez regarding Twitter. And I think that I'll put it this way. I think that the Mets need to find their own identity, and the way that they respond to the media needs to be less the way they've gone about things, whether it's too reactionary, the same way the Wilpons were overly paranoid about the back pages and everything. Maybe the Mets can do a better job of not going with the narrative when the narrative starts to just be driven into the ground.
Rich, we joked about this before the show. And I think it fits into what you're aiming at insofar as the Metsian culture, this organizational culture that right now is lacking. I brought it up as a joke. I made the connection, but you agreed with me. I was surprised initially, but, you know, I shouldn't be surprised. We are the Anaheim Angels of Los Angeles of the East Coast. They have Otani and Mike Trout. We have DeGrom and Alonso. After that, what do we have? They have a billionaire owner. We have a billionaire owner. Meanwhile, both of us are wallowing with almost identical records and out of playoff contention.
And both teams are overshadowed by another team in the same city. Exactly right. And you know, and Coop, someone we've had on this show many times, she and I have talked about that for years, how the Mets are the Angels of the National League. And for that reason, I've always rooted for the Angels. If I had to come up with a, you know, quote unquote, my favorite American League team, you know, that kind of thing, it would be the Angels. It always has been, because I feel their pain, and I know they feel our pain. And the White Sox, to a degree, are the same situation. Now, with that said, guys, the other part of my article I wanted you to comment on, then we'll go into the going forward part of our show, was I talked about leadership. When you see the Once Upon a Time in Queens, what you see here, I'm going to point to Davey Johnson. I was okay with Davey. I wasn't in love with the guy. But think about that thing with the airplane, right? When Cashin said, you guys are going to pay for the airplane because, you know, you made a mess of it after coming home from Houston after winning the NLCS. And he said to Cashin, we're not paying for a damn thing because we're about to win you a World Series and you should be thankful. So, no, thank you very much. We're not paying for your airplane. Okay, yes, I know times are different 36 years ago, and I know the manager's role is reduced now. I get all that. And I'm not trying to single out Luis Rojas. I'm talking about general leadership on the team. But don't you think that when something like that happened, we knew, or the team knew, that someone had our back? This was our guy. He had our back to ownership. The Mets lack that, whether it's from the manager's office, whether it's a Keith Hernandez. The Mets don't have somebody who's a leader like that. They all talked about it, how Gary was the leader, so to speak, but Keith was the real leader. Mets have none of that. If you tried to identify a leader on this team, I don't think you see from Rojas what you saw from Johnson in that example. You don't have an analog of a Carter or a Hernandez. You just don't have that on this team. Who is it? Pete? No, I'm sorry. Pete breaks bats over his knee when he fails. And yes, he says things. He's always on the post game, but he doesn't have that thing that makes him the leader. You can't point to him. Lindor may be on the infield. He's kind of like the infield captain, and maybe he'll get there. He's brand new here. We all get that. Maybe if Baez comes back, I think he actually has the best shot at being the leader on the team. Personally, I think if he comes back, give it a year or two, I think he really could be the Hernandez. But what do you guys see? I see the Mets as sorely lacking leadership. Mike, you first go with it, please.
I agree, and I can't add much to it. I agree with you 100%. And, you know, before I blame players and management, I blame the front office. They need to get this house in order. And that's all I'll say about that. You know, but Luis Rojas is definitely up for review. You know, whether he returns, well, he probably is returning next season. But, you know, let's not forget that Steve Cohen has not yet completed his first year as owner of this team. That anniversary comes in November. And I'm anticipating an off-season unlike we've experienced in the recent past. Let's just say that. He had his season, his first season. It is what it is. I'm looking for changes. I'm not saying where to start and who to start with, in order, and then everything else will trickle down. You know, get the president in order, get the general manager in order, and then you get the management in order, and then you get the players in order. I will agree. Some of these players do not, you know, belong on this team anymore for all the reasons that we brought up, either lack of production or lack of leadership or lack of chutzpah, whatever the case may be. You know, some are worthy of keeping, some, you know, we have to move on. Some are just out of place, and we have, you know, we really don't know what to do with them. Jeff McNeil and Dom Smith among them. And Rich, this is a point that has always driven us crazy, playing people out of position. You know, so there's a lot of different directions that, you know, it all has to converge on one, you know, functional organization, and it starts at the top. And that's where I like to build. Look around baseball. Look what San Diego did. They totally stripped it down, drafted, supplemented. Look where they are now. They're in contention. Even if they don't make the playoffs, they're a good, sound team. Look at the White Sox. Stripped it down, suffered for a couple of years, drafted well. Look where they are now. You know, and we already made the comparison to the Angels. But look at some of these new upcoming teams. Look how they went about it. Look how we went about it. And look where we are today.
Fair enough. Sam, leadership on the Mets. Do you think it's an issue?
Oh, for sure. And, yeah, I mean, the point you made about Davey Johnson, regardless of your overall opinion about the breadth of his work, when it comes to 1986, he could really do no wrong. I mean, just look at the way he introduced himself in 1984 with such braggadocio, but also a humor that showed that he can bring light to the situation and not be so serious, like Adam Gaze, who would never laugh at a comedy club. It's Sunday, I'm allowed to mention football. But whether it's the manager, whether it's the players like we're talking about, yeah, I can't – you said maybe Baez. But right now, this is 1983, you know, and, like, the way they've been playing the last half of the season, it's basically the opposite 1983, split reverses regarding these records. So the Mets – and, yes, it really – I think – whether it has to do with the fact that Sandy Alderson did not expect to have this much operational responsibility, and they made just one poor hire after one poor hire when it comes to the general manager, something wasn't clearly right all the way at the top. And that is the number one reason why this team, the 2021 New York Mets, absolutely collapsed beyond comprehension.
They did that for sure. The fall from grace, and, you know, Mike shared the numbers. It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. That was good by definition. They were in first place for a good amount of time. Maybe not great, but good. You can collapse like that. How do you do that? How do you go from good to abysmal? Don't you go from good to mediocre? Or good to kind of bad? You go from good to abysmal like that? It's unbelievable. All right, so guys.
I don't think any of us anticipated a sub-500 season.
No, not in June. If someone told you in June when the Mets were 11 over 500 after they beat the Cubs the third of four, they lost the fourth game of that series, but they won the first three at Citi, and they were 11 games over 500, if someone were to tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, Mike, hey, Sam, they're going to end up below 500. You're going to laugh. Come on. Below 500? Come on. Maybe not win the division. Okay, they're the Mets. We get that. Below 500, no way. No, that's exactly what's going to happen. It's exactly what's going to happen. And they have looked so bad in the process. So I want to get to the going forward. It's a good segue into it. Because part of me thinks maybe there's a silver lining here. You know, Steve Cohen is watching this. He doesn't like to lose. You know he's watching, and he is watching his $2.4 billion investment not just not make the playoffs, part of the double negative, but also look horrible in the process, not even talking about the off-the-field stuff. Let's talk about the on-the-field. So, okay, are big changes coming? Of course they are. We know that they have to start with the POBO, you know, President of Baseball Operations, and then a GM, yes. I don't want to get into that now because we'll have plenty of time to do that. What I want to do, I'm going to throw some names at you guys, and I'm going to ask you to tell me what you would do with that player, should that player come back or not. Because what I think is kind of funny is when I read Twitter, a lot of people say things like, well, you know, the chemistry has changed and the everything has changed, but we can't get rid of this guy, and basically they want the whole team back. Well, it doesn't work like that. You know, if you think that the chemistry has to change and the culture has to change and the team has changed, you can't then identify 18 to 20 of the guys in the current roster and say, bring them all back. I mean, it doesn't work like that. Like Sam said, we're going to have to put on our big boy pants and make some big boy decisions, and maybe players that we might like aren't the right fit here. Okay, so let's start. Let's start with the biggest one, in my opinion, Marcus Stroman. He cannot get a qualifying offer because he just had one. So he hits free agent market. Mike, bringing him back, yes or no?
Oh, wow. Toughest question of the night, Rich. I honestly don't know.
Why
I'm a big
that?
Pitcher
Why
guy, you know that. Stay or go? Sign him.
Mike, I'm a little surprised at your hesitation. So, and I'm not question. I want you to share. Why would you hesitate? I'm just want to hear why you would hesitate.
It's more philosophical, Rich. I'm into team building, and I think that's what the Mets need. I'm kind of more leaning towards a more dramatic change, as you say, than retaining a large portion of these players. That's where I am. I'm looking for change. So I'm kind of leery, you know, to extend him. But he's performed. I can't deny him that. He's been a good Met. So, you know, I'm going to bite my tongue and say sign him. But for me, it's team building. And I think that's where the Mets have a real big problem right now. And I think they need to address that. And that's why I'm hesitant to keep things in place so easily.
Fair. Sam, Marcus Stroman, back or see ya?
It's a tough one, but the 2021 season showed us a lot about this team. And I think one of those things is that the Mets have a starting pitching problem. We thought, as the season was going into it, that we were past the idea of the Rick Porcellos and the Michael Wachas filling this rotation. But when you really think about it, the Mets could have used those bodies this year, crazy enough. How can I say that the Mets shouldn't sign Marcus Stroman? He's pitched well, and they need quality starting pitching. I think I don't want to say it's a no-brainer, but it's just every time I think to myself, no, you shouldn't bring Marcus Stroman back, it doesn't sound right to say.
I'm going to say bring him back because I do like his pizzazz. I think it plays well in New York. And I think, but from a baseball perspective, you're right. I mean, where's the starting pitching going to come from? They don't have it in the minor leagues. We already learned that they were short in starting pitching when we saw that they had to bring, you know, Jared Eichhoff back 600 times. So, you know, we know that they're thin in the organization. Stroman has been their ace since the Grom went down. To me, it's like, I don't see how you don't. I mean, I think he's a good fit. I do, and I think from a baseball perspective, you need him. All right, next guy. Questions only get harder, kids. Michael Conforto. I'm going to give you three choices. Which one are you taking? There are only three choices. See you, Michael. Have a good life. You know, go sign somewhere else on the open market. Try to extend him now before he hits the open market or qualifying offer. Mike, which one do you do?
Qualifying offer.
Why is that?
Performance. Like I said early in the show, his performance over the last bunch of years does not warrant perhaps what Scott Boras is seeking. And this year, you know, is a standalone debacle. So I think all parties are probably going to be content, you know, the Mets extending the qualifying offer and Boras and his client accepting it and then, you know, gambling on him throughout the season, hoping to parlay that into a big contract after the 2022 season.
I find your answer surprising because I don't think it's a bad one, but I think when it comes to changing culture, and I think, again, we have to start making some big boy decisions. I would have thought you would have said, as much as we love Michael, and we do, maybe he's one of the ones who has been here a while and hasn't worked. Okay, but I respect what you're saying. I think that is a logical way to go, qualifying offer. So, Sam, your thought on Conforto.
I look at the rest of the free agent outfield class, and I wonder whether we can get – what we're looking for out of Michael with that culture change somewhere else. Can you guys tell me which player on the Brewers they said will most likely he's going to be a free agent? It's like something in his contract triggers him to be a free agent. Do you guys remember who I'm talking about?
It was said during the broadcast, sure. And I don't. Right.
I'd have to look up the Brewers roster, and I will right after I make the point. But there are some interesting options outside of dealing with Scott Boras when it comes to Michael Conforto after 6 years here of him not fulfilling his expectations. And, you know, I guess it's like, yes, you could say that basically Conforto is the wheeler of hitting right at this point, like 2 years later. But I think there was just something more personal when it came to Wheeler, and from both parties, the fact that from a fan perspective and then from Wheeler perspective, the fact that they were so cold to him hurt. Conforto, there's still something, regardless of the pocket of fans that he has, and he does have one in me, there just seems to not be that same. Like, there was that story with Wheeler about when he almost got traded for Wilmer Flores, about going to Sandy Alderson. So I don't see that same personal connection, and I see that maybe even with like a 2-year deal with Starlin Marte, like there's some options here. I'm curious to find out what you think, Rich.
You know, I think that may be a tough decision they have to make, because Conforto, I always thought he would win a batting title. I sit here watching the games with my daughter saying that man's going to win a batting title. It's been 6 years now. He had a great 2017 until he got hurt. He had a strong finish in 2019, but we haven't seen a consistent body of work. So, okay, what I'm going to say about Conforto is extending the qualifying offer. Even though I would not be terribly disappointed if he went somewhere else, and he may. Boras may get him a 3-year deal somewhere else. But I would say extend a qualifying offer. It's not the worst thing in the world if he comes back, because it could be the year that he puts it all together. And it's not the worst thing in the world if he goes, because you get the draft pick, and maybe that's where the culture starts to change. So that's my take. I think it's kind of like Mike said, you set yourself up for a win either way if you send him the qualifying offer, because it wouldn't be horrible to bring him back, but it also might not be the worst thing if he went somewhere else. So that's my take on that one. Okay, next one, guys. A little bit of a different spin here. Jerry Familia. He is going to be a free agent. Mike, start with you again. What do you do?
He's expendable. He's expendable. He may not be here next year.
No.
I mean, I don't mind bringing him back, but, you know, again, team building. It's tough because, as both of you said, you know, we get accustomed to these players. We grow a liking to these players. But he's expendable.
Sam.
I think he is a perfect example of culture change, you know.
Agreed.
Going all the way back to, I mean, Mike, when did they draft him, Mike? I bet you know off the top of your head.
Oh, you know, that was a while ago, maybe 10 years ago at this point. You know, him and Henry.
I mean, at this point,
Mejia,
we've heard his name for 10, right, exactly. We've heard his name. We've heard Jerris Familia's name for 10, 11 years, quite possibly since like 2008, 2009. So I think it's time, yes.
Agreed. Okay. Other guys whose contracts might not be expiring, but we have to start thinking about. Jeff McNeil. Mike, I'll just keep going, Mike, Sam, just for the sake of Mike. Jeff McNeil, what do you do with him? Try to find him a new home or keep him around?
I try to find him a new home. He just doesn't fit here. He doesn't have a solid position, a consistent position. And, you know, I don't want to jump ahead. Players on my bubble. He's one of them.
Sam.
I think there's a lot of players, I think there's a lot of teams that could use a McNeil. So it would be interesting to see how McNeil could be used, let me ask you something, Rich, right now. Do you regret doing a Lindor trade with the players that we gave up? just even after a year?
I do not regret the trade. I regret the 10-year deal, and not because – I said it at the time, not because of the way it played out. I think 10 years for a position player like that is too much.
Now, I know Ahmed Rosario had a pretty solid last few weeks, but I think it just goes to, like, I'll just put it this way. I don't think we can always live in fear that every player is going to become a Daniel Murphy or a Justin Turner. Jeff McNeil was on my bubble, too.
Yeah, I think he's got to go. I like Jeff McNeil. I think Jeff Cohen, who's been on our show, said it best. I thought it was freaking brilliant what he said. He said McNeil came up as a slap hitter, which is why Sandy didn't love him, because Sandy doesn't really like guys who have power. He came up as a slap hitter. Then he became a power hitter, and now he doesn't know what he is. I think that's exactly right. When you look at him, he looks like he's in between. He doesn't know what he is. Is he a power hitter, a guy trying to for power? Is he a slap hitter? Sometimes he'll try to slap hitting like he did against the Red Sox. He buried a few in the left field corner. Or is he trying to pull the ball and hit everything out of the ballpark? I don't think he knows. And I think they messed with this kid. But I think he's got to go. I think his antics are wrong. I'm a little sick of him, you know, having a hissy fit when he doesn't get a hit. I'd rather see him just get some hits. And there's clearly something with him and Lindor. And I, while they might, you know, smooth it over, it's underneath the surface. He culture changed. He's got to go. And not that I don't like the guy, he's got to go. Dom Smith, Mike.
He's on my bubble. And only because we don't have a real place to put him. Is he a first baseman? Is he a left fielder? I think he's, you know, valuable. I think he's capable of bringing back, you know, good players that will fit more appropriately in the Mets. He's on my bubble.
Sam.
I think he's most likely going to be a casualty of trade. However, I think that Jeff McNeil and Dom Smith are in very similar places, but while Jeff McNeil is outside my bubble, Dom is more inside the bubble because I think insurance and first base, Jeff McNeil doesn't really provide that, and he doesn't provide the type of defensive insurance that Dom provides for first base. Not to mention he is, except for just some moments here and there where you still see those left field instincts not quite there, but he's subtracted those so much that it's very impressive how good he is out there. And you still need players like that. So I actually go with keep Dom Smith.
I think whether or not there's a DH in the National League has a lot to do with it because I don't want to see Dom in the outfield. Not that he's terrible, but if he could play first and peak a DH, you know, for the most part, maybe keep Dom around. But again, I'm not going to lose any sleep if he goes. I think he might be another example of we like these guys, and I think that's what we have to think about. Is it about liking Dom Smith and we all love the guy, or is it about making some big decisions and bringing in some fresh talent? And that might be a place where you have to do it. But again, I do think the DH thing matters.
I will add this, Rich. I will add this. One of the most ponderous things I've heard this season is the Mets weren't prepared to hit the fastball. So some of these players got to go. You got to bring in more different players. You got to mix it up.
And I can't wait for your next player, Rich. I think I know who it's going to be.
I don't think you do because, and you could throw one out too. But I have someone in mind. But this might not be where you're going. Mike, give me your thoughts on Edwin Diaz. He is, some Met fans love him. I'm in that group for the stuff he has. Some Met fans don't like him because of his, I mean, honestly with Diaz, let's face it. When he throws his first pitch, you can tell if he's on or off that day. And when he's off, oof. But when he's on, my God, he's devastating. Mike, Edwin Diaz, do you look somewhere for a closer or do you have a closer?
I stick it out one more year with him for all the reasons that you said. You know, relieving, let's just call it for what it is. It's a pain in the ass. So for all the reasons you said, Rich, I'll stick it out one more year with him.
You know, I think it's simple enough. Stick it out one more year with him. You know, especially now that we can't even see what he's going to do in the playoffs. Like, Could you say one of the reasons why we're not going to be in the playoffs? But at this point, like Edwin Diaz, especially because of during this stretch, he's hardly been even able to blow games. So
I'm thinking he's 27. He's still learning his craft, and he'll get better.
Time for the big one, guys. This might have been what you were thinking, Sam. Time for the biggest one that I think is facing your organization. Javier Baez. So I want you to think about a lot of different things. I want you to think about, when you answer this question, likely, from what I read, 5 years, 175 might be what it takes to keep him. Now, granted, there are a lot of shortstops. I know he's not a shortstop with the Mets, but a lot of shortstops, Trevor Story, a couple of others, Correa on the market, might suppress his value. So before you answer, think about this. They've got Lindor, 10, 341. Baez, let's just work with 5, 150. Like it's Monopoly money, right? 5, 150. He will be playing out of position. My God, if you're not watching the Yankees, Red Sox, oh my goodness. This is the Boston Massacre all over again. Sorry about that.
Check this out.
So he will be playing out of position, but also factor in that Francisco Lindor, who apparently has Steve Cohen's ear, as you might imagine, he's the franchise player with the contract they gave him, he and DeGrom are. Lindor apparently has Steve Cohen's ear and said, basically, Mr. Cohen, paraphrasing, you know, write the blank check. I want my guy here. He's my guy. Baez is a player the Mets haven't seen the likes of him in a long time. He is an amazing athlete. The things he could do on the baseball field haven't been seen in Flushing maybe since a young Strawberry. Power, speed, defense, all those things. Yes, he strikes out. I'll take the strikeouts to get his talent. My opinion, before I go to you, Mike, open the damn checkbook and write the man the check for whatever in the living hell he wants. My opinion. Mike, go with it.
I'm with you. You know, I don't think money's going to be the issue. I'm not averse to keeping him around. Him and Lindor, you know, they fostered a good on-field relationship during the World Classic together. They played together, so they have that understanding together. They'll be at second. I'm okay with that if the Mets want to keep him around. I'm copacetic with, you know, having those two guys up the middle. Open up the checkbook. You know, if you're going to do it, get it done. So I'm okay with that. You know, I can live with all the strikeouts for as long as he maintains that 500 slugging and upwards or close to 900 OPS. You know, that's what I'm more concerned with. Everyone's striking out now. He just seems to strike out more than others at times. But, you know, that's something we can live with if he provides all the other production.
Very good. Sam, Baez.
Oof. Just got hit. So I will tell you what I think of Baez, which I've been saying all along, and then I will mention my name. Since you already, Rich, I'll go to you after that, since you already said what you think of Javi Baez. I write the damn check. Write that check. I think if you've already invested as much money in Lindor, I think this is kind of complimentary, not to mention what everybody just said here, what Javi Baez provides. A team that you couldn't understand what Cubs fans were talking about until you saw it with your own eyes. And the fact that I don't know what the percentage of Met fans right now that it's down to that just because of Bugate think that you can never forget a blasphemy like that. It's just like, I'd hope that it's really fringe. I really would, and that the majority of Mets fans realize what just happened. And I forget what the quote is, but I'm going to pull it up right now. And this was in a Sports Illustrated article earlier. And it was Javi Baez, other than the fact that he only walked 15 times in 91 games with the Cubs, and he drew 12 during his time so far with the New York Mets. And he said, when I was Chicago, I never thought I was going to be traded. I never was planning on being with another organization, said Baez. And after I came here, things have been different, but at the same time, good. I feel like I kind of needed this to know a little bit more, a bit more of myself and work a little bit harder. That was a pretty introspective thing to hear from somebody. And having seen the way he's played and the way that he's approached the plate, I don't see how you don't want to give him the entire bank then some. And again, with everything I've said, and here's the name that I'm going to throw out, J.D. Davis. And my opinion is this is a Brody guy. This was Brody's only big thing, and it's just not working out. Go get Chris Bryant for third base. It could be a plan. But get rid of J.D. Davis. Get rid of the Wilpon guys except for DeGrom. And let's just move on from this. Rich.
Oh, my God, yes. J.D. Davis has to go. I mean, J.D. Davis, granted, might be a DH in the National League, and he is clearly a DH. But there's something wrong there. I've heard people speculate that he's a leak to the media. He clearly he threw Pete under the bus when he, you know, mouthed, come on, Pete, WTF, when Pete didn't dig out one of his throws. That really was a bad throw. There's something there that just seems weird with him. He's definitely got to go. I mean, I no question. Mike, what do you think?
I have no choice but to answer this way. I don't care about J.D. Davis. I don't care what the Mets do at third base next year. What I don't want to happen is I don't want to see Mark Vientos or Brett Beatty at third base in Flushing next year. I don't want to see them anywhere near Flushing. So to me, third base is up in the air. I don't care what they do to it. Just as long as Vientos or Beatty doesn't arrive in Flushing next season and they wait till 2023, because Met fans, baseball fans, the American population is just way too impatient. And that's something that's going to really piss me off, Rich, if they force these guys up too soon. So J.D. Davis, keep him, jettison him, shoot him into the moon. I don't care. You know, third base, for as long as they open up that position the way they did with Sam, help me out, the shortstop. You just mentioned them.
Ahmed Rosario.
Ahmed Rosario, correct. Excuse me. The Mets opened up shortstop and handed him the position with no qualms, no potholes, no, you know, obstruction. They said, here, the position is yours. Now you play. And they thought they did it at a time when they thought he was ready. Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, as far as 2022, I don't care who plays third. Honestly, that's how I feel. Just as long as they don't promote Mark Vientos or Brett Beatty, I don't want to see them rush. That's my priority, and that's going to be a sticking point of mine throughout the offseason and perhaps next season as well.
Well, good point on that, Mike, and that would be very Wilpon-like to rush those guys, but also it's another thing. And it kind of leads you to where I want to go as we, you know, as we begin to wrap. And by the way, you're listening to the Metsian Podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. We thank you for doing so. And as we start to turn the corner toward home here, one thing that we do need to think about is at some point, you know, a lot of people are saying sign Chris Bryant, and that would make sense, right? If you're getting rid of J.D. Davis. I love Jonathan VR. Maybe he comes back. Maybe he doesn't. If he does, he should come back in a utility role. But then that brings up the question about at what point, you know, you can't just go out and buy everybody. You know, there has to be some limit to the payroll. And we don't know what it will look like under the new collective bargaining agreement that, let's hope to God, happens, so they're going to have a strike next year. But, you know, there will be some limit. Even the Dodgers stop somewhere on their payroll. So at some point, the Mets, you know, do you sign Chris Bryant for 5 years when you have these two guys who might be ready in a year or two? That may not make sense. So they may right. need to do something a little more short-term at third base. I don't think it should be J.D. Davis. I think he's a perfect example of getting rid of some culture. But you're right, Mike. rushing those guys now is a way to save money so you can overspend somewhere else. That would just ruin their careers and would be very Wolpanian. So I don't think they will do that under Cohen and whoever he brings in. And they definitely should not rush these guys, even if it's a way of saying, look, we spent on Baez, we spent on Stroman, or whoever it might be. You know, we need to go a little, need to do a, not that they would say it like this, but they need to do a budget move at third base. That would be horrible use of personnel. And let's hope that does not happen.
Let's not forget the elephant in the room, Robinson Cano.
They have to figure that out.
And he's probably going to wind up at third. That's probably the plan heading into next year.
It may be. You have to pay him anyway. And it may well be. All right, gentlemen, it's time to start wrapping it up. But I have one more question for you. The Mets have 7 games left. I'm actually going to one of them on Thursday night. Imagine that. And they have 7 games left. Is there anything that you want to see? And I'll throw out a couple of thought starters in the next 7 games. So we might see Noah Syndergaard. In fact, it's pretty likely we will. I'm hearing he might pitch twice. One inning or so out of the pen twice. So that might happen. Jacob DeGrom, I have to think no on that one because he's just not close. I know he wants to get out there, so maybe we see that. So Syndergaard, DeGrom, anything else you're looking for over the next 7 games, or are you more or less taking the perspective of let's get this over with and start planning for 2022? Mike, where are you?
I'm a little bit I'm a little bit in a rush to get the season over with and start planning for 2022. We got the Marlins coming up. It's always fun beating them because they beat us most of the time. And I wouldn't mind playing spoiler with the Atlanta Braves and, shake their world up a little bit. But, let's get this done and let's get to work on 2022. That's where I am.
Sam?
At this point, I'd rather DeGrom light toss in the Arizona Fall League. I don't know what the idea of bringing him back. Noah Syndergaard, on the other hand, getting a couple innings here and there because they wanted to use him as a reliever anyway. I think that one makes more sense coming back from Tommy John surgery than DeGrom. I may go to the single admission doubleheader on Tuesday and just forget about how miserable the collapse was and just enjoy 14 innings of baseball and maybe more.
Yeah,
there you go.
14 innings, that's funny. By the way, I don't want to see either one of them. I don't want to see DeGrom. I don't want to see Thor. I really don't. Why? Why bother?
Well, it's an interesting debate because, when you listen to, guys like us, never played in the major leagues, a lot of us say that. What's the point? The games are meaningless. What if he blows out his elbow in DeGrom's case or Thor? Goodness knows what could happen. That seems to be the impression a lot of us have. A lot, like Zeal, I know, says, if these guys want to get back on the mound, it's really important that they do because it's good for their mental sanity to go through, as a player, which we are not, you really need to know where you stand going into the offseason. It would be less comfortable to go into the offseason with question marks. If you go out there, if you're DeGrom, you throw 3 really good innings with no pain, you're going to feel a lot better about yourself. So I get that. I do. I would rather not see these guys, but I think you're definitely going to see Syndergaard because he has to play for his future. I mean, the Mets might or might not offer. We didn't talk about him, but they might or might offer him a QO. And a lot of that is because what other teams might think is because you haven't seen this guy in 2 years. So I get it. I see both sides of the argument. I do think we'll see Syndergaard, though, although I think it's kind of weird that we might see Syndergaard throw only 2 pitches. Like, he only can throw a fastball and changeup because that's what's throwing some breaking. We talked about that last night. So, all right, guys, before we go to the last word, I think we owe it to Noah. He's been around since 2015. What should you do with Noah? Mike, you first.
I'm so torn what to do. I have to go back to the Stroman question. This question and what Jacob DeGrom is going to do once his option comes up. Will he opt in or will he opt out? And that's my dilemma. And that's the only way I can answer this question. But I do see it's been spoken about previously and recently that perhaps Noah Syndergaard's future is as a reliever. I'm copacetic with that. I'm copacetic to keeping them around. But if they let him go, again, philosophically speaking, I'm about team building, and that's what I want to see.
Sam, what do you do with Noah?
I think that it makes sense to extend him the qualifying offer. Maybe he's able to be a starting pitcher next year. Maybe his future is as a reliever, and maybe he can only pitch two pitches. You know, that is concerning for sure, that entire thing, but you know, he's got enough of a track record, I think, to both be for this to be mutually beneficial, building value back up.
Well, it's an interesting question with him, and I think maybe it's good that there will be a new Pobo and a new GM, because I think when we see Noah as fans, I'm not suggesting this is what you guys just did, but I think a lot of fans, you might say, oh, you know, you have to make these decisions coldly based on what's best for the organization and all this kind of thing. But I think with Noah and Conforto, sometimes our hearts do get involved. We're not even be aware that our hearts are involved in what we're saying. But Noah's been here a long time. You know, he has a personality, he has charisma and chutzpah and all those things. Does that mean he should be back? Is that factoring in? Maybe for us is, maybe for us it isn't. But I'll tell you what, when they go, as Mike likes to say, off campus and bring in a new president of baseball operations, new GM, these people won't think that way. And they'll make an evaluation on Noah based on if the QO, and again, we don't know what it's going to be because of the new collective bargaining agreement, but if the qualifying offer is, let's just say it's $19 million, let's say that's what it comes out to, what these folks are going to say is, you have a guy who hasn't pitched in 2 years. We saw two innings, and he threw a 94. I think he's sitting like in the mid-90s at this point. We haven't seen him throw a breaking ball. Should we think about $19 million for this guy for 1 year, or should we think about it's time to move on? And they'll make a cold, hopefully they'll make a cold, calculated decision based on baseball. And I'm not saying don't bring him back. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I'm just wondering if we as fans subconsciously let our hearts get involved in a lot of these decisions, and Noah might be one because he's kind of bigger than life with his personality, let's be honest. It's interesting. Interesting discussion. Anything else to add on that one before we move to our final word?
No,
I'll just say
right.
I could see.
We all do it.
And I could see Noah being in the booth one day or some sort of sports commentary.
But
oh, for sure.
We're all guilty, you know. We're all guilty. We become attached to these players. We like Thor. We like Conforto. But team building. Bring people from off.
Weren't they roommates,
we're
by the way?
We're going to make these decisions for them.
All right, gentlemen. So we have reached the end of our I don't think it's our – we'll probably do one next Sunday or so, but we've reached the end of this podcast. Let's call this the elimination podcast, one that I hope you don't have to have.
Elimination round.
But the Mets have been eliminated. We had to talk about it. We had to get it out, and I think we did so productively and logically and rationally, and I thank you guys for joining me in the conversation this evening. So as we go to our final word, let's do something we typically do. So, Mike, I will go to you for your final word. And before you give it, if you could just remind people of the work you do, where they could find it, and where they could find you on Twitter.
BrooklynTrolleyBlogger.blogspot.com. It's late September, so, you know, I'm wrapping up a lot of games. I'm replaying the 1921 season with the Yankees and the Giants meeting in the World Series, all games played at the Polo Grounds. A bunch of Negro League games that I'm putting out, you know, box scores, recaps, things like that. I'm transitioning into football. Hockey and basketball is less than a month away. I'll be transitioning to that as well. I just like my New York City sports. So, you know, if you want to get the opinion of a fan like me, jump on the trolley. Otherwise, thank you, Rich. And last word, you know, the way we started off the show, I came into the season with expectations. Therefore, I am disappointed. You know, I'm not going to be too hard because the injuries to this team were just ruinous. So, you know, I'll be mild in that respect. But, yeah, I'm disappointed, man. This season's going to stick out more so than a bunch of other seasons in which we've finished with the subpar record.
Absolutely, Will. Thank you, Mike. Disappointment's a good word. Sam, you are known as the Grand Poobah of podcasting operations. So if you could tell us where we could find you on Twitter, some of the work you're doing these days, and your last word, please.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you, Mike. At @the_SamMaxwell, working on a documentary about my dad, a father, brother, actor, teacher, and veteran, looking back on his life and career as he fought pancreatic cancer. Working on Bedford and Sullivan, hopefully a television show one day about Brooklyn and their Dodgers. And always working on Mets stuff and other potential ideas, basically. So, and my final word, I guess I'll say parallels. Javi really could very well be the Keith of this generation, and he comes from an NL Central team. He recently won a championship with that NL Central team. And he's got this extra intelligent chutzpah to him that separates him from the rest of the pack. And so I'll keep echoing till they get it done. Sign Javi. I think it's the right thing to do to win another championship.
To me, I agree with you, Sam. To me, that's part of number one. And, yes, it's weird because I do agree that pitching should be the priority. I think this year showed that just how important pitching still is. Now, we talk about how in the current game, starting pitching is minimized, you know, that kind of thing. It's not as big of a deal. But you saw it. The starting pitching carried a beleaguered team in the middle of the season. And when the starting pitching failed, even when some of that beleaguered team wasn't so beleaguered anymore, you saw what happened. The team was not able to compete. So even with that said, as much as I want to bulk up the pitching, to me, job number one is still to bring Javier Baez back. I just think the talent, the Mets as an organization just have not produced that kind of talented position player. Again, Strawberry, maybe Wright. Wright certainly had, you know, power, speed, good defense. But it's very rare for this organization to have that kind of talented position player. So I really think that's part of number one. So my last word, gentlemen, is I'm going to go with the same thing Mike said. I'm very disappointed. I'm bitterly disappointed about this season. I think that part of it is expectation. Part of it is the fall from grace, you know, the tease of being in first place for more than half the season. It's a tough one to take. And I'm hoping that the silver lining, like I said earlier, is that Mr. Cohen is watching and he's not happy, and he knows, he said this on Twitter, that he appreciates the passion of the fan base doesn't go unnoticed. He said that. So hopefully he's going to, you know, hunker down and get us what we need to go to another level, because this has been excruciating this year and I'm very disappointed. So with that, I will say thank you to Mike LeCollin, to Sam Maxwell, my partners in podcasting operations. I've really enjoyed our baseball discussion tonight. Thank you to all of the listeners. Again, whether you're listening live or whether you're listening as a download, you could find our podcast wherever you find your podcast. I think we're basically everywhere at this point. And with that said, folks, enjoy the last week of baseball, of New York Mets baseball. Yes, we're all disappointed, but there are 7 games to go, and, you know, enjoy them for what they are. And we'll look forward to talking to you again in the very near future as we begin our next phase, which is off-season podcast, talking about what it's going to take for the Mets to get to where they need to be. So with that said, Sam, I always turn to you to close it out the way only you know how to do that. And what would that be?
That would be with the resounding always, no matter what. Let's go Mets. Thank you, Rich. Thank you, Mike. Take care, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Have a great night, everybody. Thanks
for listening.
Let's go
Mets.
All right. Good night. Let's go Mets. Good night.